Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and of course the views of our callers. Well, tonight, for the first hour, it's going to be open lines. We're not going to have a guest, so if you have something you'd like to talk about, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California, at 464-8295. So if you have something you'd like to talk about, why, give us a call. Otherwise, you're just going to have to listen to me for a time. But, you know, I'm really quite concerned when I see how the American people are being manipulated. And we've often quoted Edward Bernays, the father of modern-day propaganda, who back in 1928 wrote a book by that title, Propaganda, and he just talked about the skillful and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses and is an important element in democratic society. And those who manipulate this essential mechanism really constitute an invisible government that rules our land. We are governed, our minds are molded, our ideas suggested, our tastes are formed largely by men we have never heard of. And as I watch and see what's going on today, all we hear about is we're fighting a war on terrorism. We're fighting a war on terrorism. The terrorists threaten us. We're far better off, of course, to actually be fighting the terrorists in the streets of Baghdad than on the streets of New York. And yet, of course, with open borders, with a catch-and-release program, with no effort really being made at all to secure this country, we have yet to have another serious terrorist attack in 5 long years. Now, what's wrong with this picture, and what I would like to suggest is wrong with it, is that we're not being told the truth. And if you go back into the background of so many of the terrorist attacks, for instance, the terrorist attack that was on the embassies in Africa, there was a terrorist attack that was on the American embassy in Tanzania and the one in Kenya. And it was planned by a man named Ali Mohammed, who was working for our government. Now, of course, some people say he was a double agent. He was working for our government, and he was working for Al-Qaeda. And actually, we know that he was an Egyptian who joined the U.S. military, was in special forces. And then, of course, somehow he was over there training Osama bin Laden's bodyguard and helping Osama bin Laden as he was moving around into Somalia into the Sudan or out of the Sudan. And then, of course, he came back to the United States and was stopped and was eventually, he was apprehended. He was being held by the government. He said, call the FBI in Washington, D.C., and they admitted that Ali Mohammed was working for the American government. Here he was over there training Osama bin Laden's bodyguard, and he's working for the American government. And then he is the one who takes the pictures and plans the bombing of the embassies in Africa. And eventually, of course, he gives the information about that. And he testifies, but he is never convicted. And today, Ali Mohammed is living comfortably somewhere in New York, despite the fact that over 5,000 people were injured and hundreds were killed as a result of the bombing that he planned in Africa. And the question is, what's wrong with this picture? And I would like to suggest that we're not getting the picture about so much of what's going on today. And we're going to be back here in just a moment to evaluate what's really going on. We have John in Texas. We'll be glad to be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and John in Texas, how are you doing?
Doing great, Dr. Stan.
You have a question or comment?
Yes, sir. Well, I have a comment. The other night, I tried to call in on the program. There was this one man. I can't remember exactly who was being interviewed because I came in halfway on the interview. But he was stating that, he's very discouraged about what's going on in the world and the fact that, he got a book that you suggested, and that even discouraged me even more. But, what the issue is here is that, there's certain little aspects of the information that these people that are running this world are getting leaked out. And honestly, I believe they feed on that. They feed on the fear that is being created by the things that they are doing. And I just want to tell that man, if he's listening or not, do not be afraid. And if you are afraid, to please, 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 pick up your Bible and to pray. And to, because, like I've said before, this is the only way we're going to make it. It's the only way. All the events that have happened today are revolving around the Bible. Whether you want to realize it or not, I don't know. If that's the issue with most people or what, but just pick up that Bible, look at it, and look and see what's happening. And it's revolving around that book.
All right, Shirdi, I agree with what you're saying, John. We we did a wonderful program today. I don't know if you heard it with our good friend Dr. Michael Kaufman. He's got a great new DVD out, just showing how so many of the things that are going on today truly have a biblical connection. So for the Christian, this should be the most exciting time in the world. Yes, we may very well have to go through persecution. Yes, we may be facing terrible times, but we have God's promise that He will be with us even unto the end.
Yes, sir. I fully agree with that. This is a scary time for myself, having four children. But you cannot give up hope. You can't.
You're absolutely right. I don't think people do it. I hope that what we do here will be to encourage people to understand that we're involved in a spiritual battle. And not to be discouraged, because things are going to get worse. They're going to have to get worse. In fact, if they do not get worse, people are not going to be in looking for the Lord. Anything else you'd like to say, John?
Yes, sir. Goodness, I lost it, but like I say, I honestly do believe these people feed on the fear that they're making.
John, I think they're doing everything they can to frighten the people to death, and I think that the president keeps talking about this war on terror. He's doing this intentionally to frighten the people, to draw the people behind him,
exactly,
so they will be willing to accept all these draconian laws he's passing.
Exactly. And also, if I say one more thing, Dr. Stan, to all those people out there, I've recently been in discussions about this. If there are some of you out there thinking that you're gonna make some movement, take up arms and all this stuff, do not think that way. Turn away from that idea. That's my encouragement. That's what I'm saying to you. Look, my dad works for the U.S. government. He helped develop the newest. There is no way you can face these guys down with the weapons that are available to the U.S. public. The tactics, the weapons that they have are so much further advanced than anything that you have. It's completely ridiculous.
Okay, fine. John, I appreciate what you're saying, and I agree with you totally, and thanks very much for calling.
Okay, sir.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, our telephone number, again, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. That's 464-8295. And our job is not to take up weapons, other than perhaps to guard our own homes in case there is a breakdown in law and order, and we have the chaos in our communities that exists over in Iraq today, that we have brought to Iraq. But our job, of course, is to educate others about what's going on. And, of course, we're going to have to look to the Lord for strength and for help. And we're going to have to hope and pray that the majority of the people within our own military will not, of course, be willing to fire on the American people or to kill Americans here, or that the foreign troops will not be brought in. But in the final analysis, our job, of course, is to realize that it's a spiritual battle and to rely upon the Lord. So, anyway, if you have a question or comment, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And I was just wanted to get talk a little bit about some of this new legislation that President Bush had passed in October of last year. It was just last month. And specifically, the Military Commission Act, which has legalized torture. How could a Christian president legalize torture? It doesn't matter what the situation is. I mean, if you were a Christian, you did not resort to the enemy's tactics in an effort to, you know, to try to force people to give you their secrets, because torture is a very ineffective means of obtaining information. And of course, the other things that this legislation did, it had retroactive aspects to it. It really suspends the rights of habeas corpus. It allows military commissions to hold trials where you do not have any of the rules that we have in a regular court. And of course, who will be for that commission? Well, of course, anybody who's said to be an enemy combatant. Who determines whether you're an enemy combatant or not? Well, the definition of an enemy combatant is anybody who's helping the enemy, like people who are critical of the government. Could this be used against the American citizens? We know what they've done with Mr. Padilla, whether you like him or not, why he is an American citizen, and they've kept him for more than 3 years in solitary confinement and under terrible, terrible conditions and very brutal conditions. Why? Because he was asked to become an informant by the government, and he refused. And that's exactly what they did to Randy Weaver when they wanted him to become an informant. When he refused, why, they set him up for a phony situation. They hired a man to befriend him who got him to saw off a shotgun about a quarter of an inch shorter than regulations. And then when he was given a court appointment and they gave him the wrong date, they set him up from the very, very beginning, and then they killed his wife and his son. And you know that not one person in government was ever punished for that? Well, let's go to Ray, who's calling. Hi, Ray. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good. I wanted to ask you a question, but first I wanted to mention the fact that the new movie called The Jesus Camp, I went to see it, and it was very disturbing. These evangelicals people in Missouri, mostly in Missouri, near Kansas City and places like that, they're indoctrinating little kids into a really far out, far right wing kind of version of Christianity, where they actually have a cardboard figure of President Bush, and they brought it right up on the altar, and they had little kids, you know, praying to President Bush. You know, it's pretty scary.
Well, is this really accurate? I mean, is this?
Oh yeah, no, it's a
put the film out?
And it just came out. And
but Ray, who put it out? And did they have an agenda? Were they being accurate, or were they trying to discredit
evangelical Christians? They're being accurate. I think.
How do you know?
Well, for one thing, they had the newscaster on there was warning these people, you know, that. You know, you shouldn't do that to little kids. You know, you shouldn't be indoctrinating them into that kind of. You know, it's pretty.
Ray, do you believe everything that you see on the news or everything you see on television?
No, but I think that was a real. I think this was real.
I really don't know. So, well, maybe we can get somebody here could tell us about it. But, tell us a little bit more about the motion picture.
Well, they had live. You know, they had films of what went on during these religious ceremonies that they had, and they were really they're really. I'm a Catholic, so I mean I think I know true religion, true Christianity is all about. But I don't think these people are on the right track.
Well, I really don't know anything about it. I believe that there probably are some people who are on the wrong track. I just always very, very suspicious. Was this on the large screen?
No, it's a documentary.
Where did you see it?
At the Nickelodeon, Santa Cruz.
Well, I'll tell you what, the really accurate films have a very, very difficult time getting into the regular motion pictures. I really can't tell you, sometimes Nickelodeon does carry some things that will not be get onto the regular circuit. So,
well,
maybe it's true and maybe it isn't.
Yeah.
If it is true, I would share your concern.
Yeah, well, I'm very concerned about that. And I think that's it's very true. I think the Bush and Karl Rove, I think they've gone after people that they want, you know, they've garnered the support of people that are fanatics, you know. I mean, there is such a thing as a religious fanatic, and I believe that.
But why do you believe that George Bush is a religious fanatic? Have you ever met him?
No, but I...
Why would you believe that a man who would authorize torture, that he would tell the American people that he was against torture, and then we know he's authorized it,
mm-hmm.
a man who would say he's against amnesty, but he's
pushing
amnesty,
just
before the election, he said, I am not going to get rid of Donald Rumsfeld, and then after the election,
right,
he said, I was planning on it all along.
Yeah.
If a man would lie to the American people, why would you think he's a Christian?
Well, I don't.
All right,
I don't
fine.
Think he's a Christian.
So
but
I think he more to discredit Christianity than anybody else. In fact, he is going to destroy the Republican Party. He is going to destroy belief in Christianity eventually.
Yeah.
And I think that he's playing his part very well.
Oh, yeah.
He reads a script. Did you have to understand?
He may be part of the New World Order. I don't know.
He is absolutely part of the New World Order. He's a globalist. And the reason he refuses to seal our borders, the reason he's maintained a catch-and-release system by which they apprehend people coming across our border, and then if they're from other countries other than Mexico, if they're from
mm-hmm.
Mexico, they take them right back. But if they're from other countries, they immediately release them, then tell them to mm-hmm. come back for a deportation hearing, and they never do. Why would he do that?
Yeah.
And he says, you know, he doesn't believe in amnesty, but he just wants all the people who are here illegally to stay and become mm-hmm. citizens. This man does not tell the truth.
I also heard that Nancy Pelosi was a good friend of Maurice Strong, and that was kind of disturbing.
Nancy Pelosi?
Yeah.
Well, I will tell you that the leaders of both the political parties are controlled by exactly the same people.
Yeah.
Until people understand that, why, nothing really makes sense. But I share your concern about George W. Bush.
Yeah.
I mean, what we have is we have a dynasty. We have the father.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we have a 10-year gap, and then we have the son.
Yeah.
We have another son who's the governor of Florida. What's wrong with this picture?
Mm.
I thought that we were a nation, you know, we're representative of the people, not of a fabulously wealthy elite. And this, these people are fabulously wealthy.
Yeah, the Bush family. Well, the Bush family, I believe that they're sort of minor league.
I think that they're probably in the major leagues. They're just
not
the managers of the major league.
Yeah, but they're not the, it's like you said before, you know, with people like Henry Kissinger running things, you know, who needs enemies? I mean, you know, the man planned the war in Vietnam, he planned the war in Iraq, from what I hear, from what you said. He has help, though. I think the power elite, I think they hired him, probably. I don't know who they are, the Rockefellers, the family, and, you know, the rest of them. But they probably hired Henry Kissinger, you know, for a lifetime job.
I think he's done very, very well. Yes,
yeah.
I believe that, of course. We have various tiers, and I think probably above the Bushes are the Henry Kissingers and the Zygmunt Brzezinskis and the James Bakers and people like that. And above them, well, that's anybody's guess. I'm sure that we could pick a few of them, the Maurice Strongs of this world, certainly the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds. I mean, there are people, maybe we don't even know their names. They're fabulously wealthy.
Yeah, they are.
But, of course, these are people who've given themselves over to the dark
side. Yeah.
They've been well rewarded by the prince of this world for their treachery.
Yeah, that's true. And I think if people come to realize that, if more people come to realize that, and what you've been saying on the radio, of course, you know, over the past, you know, so many years, if more people came to the realization...
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest right now is Ray from Santa Cruz. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And Ray was called in to talk, comment on this movie, The Jesus Camp. If anybody knows anything about it, I'd like to know more. And it sounds to me like what they're portraying is that the evangelical Christians are really pretty far out. I do not necessarily believe with some of the things that are being done in the name of evangelical Christianity and the mega churches, certainly I would like to know more about the Jesus film. Anyway, go ahead.
Anyway, what I was going to say was, if people come to the realization that Satan has control of world affairs, Jesus even said, the kingdoms of the world were offered to him by Satan, and he turned them down. So that leads me with a feeling that I don't know whether I'm right or not, but I think that there is a devil of some kind, you know.
I think you're absolutely right. There really is a devil there.
Yeah.
Okay, anything else, Ray?
I
agree with you, and I'm glad that you've recognized this, and this is the message we're trying to get out. These are not imaginary things. There is another dimension. There is a spiritual dimension. There are beings that bridge that dimension between the world we live in and the other dimension. And these are the people, these are the beings who are directing the course of world events. And, of course, they want to discredit the Catholic Church. They want to discredit the Protestant Church. They want to discredit the Jewish people and the Jewish religion. And they have their people planted in the tops of every one of the religions here.
Yeah, it is. And, we can't fight the devil with conventional weapons.
You're absolutely right. This is where we need, of course, to pray, work as if it's up to us, but understanding the final analysis, it's God's battle.
Yeah.
Hey, God bless.
Okay,
thanks very much, Ray.
Thanks.
Now let's go to Mary calling from Covina. Hi, Mary. How are you?
Hi, Dr. Stan. I wanted to tell you about something that happened at my church. I go to a Baptist church, and our pastor is really good, and talks about homosexuality and all the things. He's really good. And I had given a woman at the church your book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, and apparently she didn't like it, and so he called me on that. And I thought about, why did this happen? Because actually I had approached him on something else, and then he took the opportunity to tell me he didn't want me to give out a book, and he called it a conspiracy book. So I decided that if he opened the door, I would go ahead and I would talk to him about some things and why I want to inform people, that most people don't know what's going on. And he said, so anyway, I made an appointment with him, and we were talking about different things, and all of a sudden, he was acting like most things that I was bringing up weren't really true. Like, how did I know? And all this kind of stuff, goes on. And then he mentioned Bush, and I said, and I mentioned something about Bush and made reference to the fact that he was no Christian. And he goes, no, I believe he's a Christian. And I was just dumbfounded, and I said, the Bible says for us to look at their fruit. I said, he says all the things that we, that are right, but he never does it. If one really looked and saw it, and it didn't go anywhere. So we were there for an hour, my husband and I, and we had to leave. And
hold that thought for just a moment, Mary. We'll be right back here in just a moment.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And this is Open Line Wednesday. Mary's calling from Covina. Apparently she goes to a Baptist church, and she thinks the minister does a good job. She'd given some woman in the church a copy of my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and the woman didn't like it. And I guess she went to the minister and complained, and the minister called Mary and told her that she shouldn't be handing out books like that. Well, of course, my book is about the conspiracy against God. This is really the underlying theme. I don't know whether he read the book or he simply just took what had been said about it. But people may read the book and they may not like it. And there are many, many good Christians out there who honestly believe George Bush is a good Christian. They have the right to their opinion. But of course, people have the right not to disagree. That's the wonderful thing in a free society. So anyway, Mary, go ahead, tell the story. You spent about an hour talking to their minister along with your husband. Then what happened?
Well, my main goal was for him to call us to prayer, to alert the people to what's going on. I think it's 2 Chronicles 7:14.
If the people who are known by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear them from heaven and forgive their sin and heal their land.
Right. But I was so shocked to think that a pastor would think that he would be taken in by Bush.
But I do not fault him for that. I will tell you, I know some of the leading Christian leaders of this country. The primary ones, and they're all taken in by him. I belong to I'm leaving a very prestigious organization simply because the people there all think the same and they're supporting this war. And I cannot support the war and the carnage that's going on over there. I can't support torture. And I may love these people, I think a great deal of them, but I think they're wrong.
Well, I told him that. I reminded him of how God tells us just because somebody says they're a Christian, you'll know them by their fruits. And I talked about that he never did anything about abortion and all that kind of stuff. And then I got on the internet on Cutting Edge because he has a list of his good fruits and his bad fruits. You know, he's only got about 3 things in the column of good fruits and about 63 things that are the bad fruits. And I plan on and I printed it up, and I plan on taking it to the pastor. I just couldn't believe that, and I don't know, I hope it'll do some good, but it really let me down because I thought, well, if he doesn't even see that, I don't know if it's because I've been listening to you for so many years that I know what's going on, but it's like, why can't these people see this? But see, I'm seeing everything through the eyes of being informed, and they're not.
There is a spirit of blindness out there. There really is, Mary. And so don't fault the minister. He probably loves the Lord. He's probably a good man. But he probably meets with a lot of other ministers. They all believe George Bush is a born-again Christian because the Christian leaders of this country say he is. And if they all say it, how could that possibly not be true?
Well, you know what he said about a lot of stuff that my husband and I told him?
What?
Like, how do you know that? How do you know that? And after I came away from the meeting with him, and he told me the reason he knows George Bush is a Christian is because he reads the Bible every morning.
How does he know he reads the Bible every morning?
Exactly. And that's what I thought. I thought, oh, I wish I... It was hard, though, because he's a real talker, and he hogged most of the conversation. But I thought, why didn't I say to him, how do you know? So, in other words, you're taking somebody's word for it, because I know you're not there at the White House. You don't see him read the Bible. But I haven't given up. I'm taking this paper to him, and I'm going to be praying that he gets enlightened, because he is, like I say, a good man, and he brings up the stuff that he should. He's talked about, in fact, in Hollywood, when they were making a movie, they wanted to use our church, because it was a movie about Muhammad Ali, and they said that was the church looked like the one he grew up in, and he flat out turned them down. He said they would have given us money, they were going to let people in the congregation be in the movie, and he said, you love what I hate, and I hate what you love, and he went, no.
I'd say he's a good man, and mm-hmm. I just pray for him.
Yeah. All righty.
But I tell you, if people say, how do you know these things are true, I would suggest tell them to, the information is there, and if he would read Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, we'd even, of course, go ahead and send you one if he would promise to read the whole thing through, a book written by Bill Clinton's mentor, or get him some of the documentation that we have. I mean, ask him, you know, some of the leading questions. Has he ever heard of Operation Keelhaul? That's, of course, where we actually sent Roosevelt and Churchill and the European leaders sent 6 million Russians back to be executed in Russia at the end of the Second World War. Ask him how that could be concealed, or the great hunger that occurred in China between 58 and 62, where they starved to death between 30 and 43 million Chinese people. How could that be, you know, and nobody would ever heard about it? Suggest to him that maybe most of what he read in the papers is not true. But you'll never convince him. He's going to have to convince himself. Hey, thanks so much, Mary.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We've got Laverne calling from Spokane. But if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment, give us a call. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Go ahead, Laverne.
Dr. Stan, on KSPS last night, I saw Bill Gates' School of the Future, and all around were shelves for books that were completely empty, and on every desk was a computer. And our skills in writing, you know, the pen is mightier than the sword. Our skills in communicating and has always been through, or you know, speech and writing. And are they slowly getting rid of our books now?
Yep.
Anyway, people across this United States, if they contacted their congressman in mass, it would take a lot of people contacting their congressman throughout the United States on the issues that are so serious today. They could accomplish a lot. And we vote with our money, you know. We don't have to buy China. We don't have to buy Mexican. We vote when we go at Christmas time and shop. I won't, you know, if there's no Christmas, no nativity, nothing, I go shop elsewhere.
Good for you.
And I shop over the, you know, buy things from talk shows, too, that are offered. But it can be done, don't you think?
It could be if people would actually get in. And, of course, you know, actually it's very interesting that Walmart last year boycotted Christmas and forbade their people to say Merry Christmas. And it was a happy holiday season or something like that, and would not allow, of course, any recognition of Christmas. And Don Wildman for the American Family Association organized a boycott, and this year, you know, Walmart, a multi-billion-dollar company, one of the strongest, most powerful companies in the world, now is going to recognize Christmas. Yeah, we have a great deal of power. We need to be organized, and we need to act as a unit, but we can accomplish a great deal if we, the people, will ever join together in a common effort to try to take America back and to educate people about what's going on.
Well, Bill Gates plans to put $200 million into those type of schools across America.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Laverne. She's calling from Spokane. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, and this is Open Lines. And Laverne was just saying that she saw a program on television up in the Spokane area where she lives, and it was with Bill Gates, and he was talking about the schools of the future. There were no books at all. Everybody had a computer, and that's how they're going to get the information. The trouble is, if you can control the flow of information on the computer, why, you can control what people read and what they see, and ultimately what they believe.
Okay.
And I agree with Laverne. She thinks we ought to have books, and I believe that too, but I think what we need are the great books of the past, the books that our founding fathers read, the story of what happened in ancient Rome. We need to read Plato, and we need to read Aristotle. We need to understand that these men were deeply involved in the occult. They were part of the mystery religions. Understand what they were saying, but understand the spiritual background of these men's belief and how profound an impact that has had, not only on the development of Western civilization, but as Christianity itself. And, of course, what we need to understand then, of course, is the teachings of the Bible and how they differ from those of Aristotle and Plato. We need to understand what happened to ancient Rome. We need to understand what happened to ancient Greece. We need to understand what our founding fathers believed and why America is unique and different than other nations. Yeah. But they're not going to get that material off the computer, because most of what they're going to get will be from a centralized authority, so that everybody in the country, every grade, will be taught exactly the same things, and the ideas that the elite want programmed into their mind will become their reality. I think Bill Gates is a very frightening man, and all one needs to know that is he is, of course, going to go ahead and spend tens of billions of dollars vaccinating children all throughout the world because he loves children, and yet he's in favor of population control. How could you possibly want to save the lives of children and be in favor of population control? Well, Bill Gates is a very, very smart man. And I'm sure that he is well aware of the fact that there's mercury in those childhood vaccines, and this influences fertility, not only in this generation, but in generations to come. And I'm sure he also knows it lowers the intelligence because of the mercury toxicity. He knows, of course, what it's doing here in this country. So don't be too concerned that Bill Gates is really concerned about helping the children in underdeveloped countries. You can't be in favor of population control and be in favor of saving the lives of children and unborn children.
And lastly, of course, one world government, Ben, isn't he?
Right. Well, basically, if you go to the New Group of World Servers, that's the New Group of World Servers, which is a front for the Lucius Trust, and you actually go and find their financiers, one of the financiers of the New Group of World Servers is the Melinda and Bill Gates Foundation. Of course, the Jimmy Carter Foundation is there. Other foundations are made up of some of the most wealthy and powerful men in the United States. And they're all funding an organization which is a front for a Luciferian organization. Now, maybe they just don't know what they're doing. Maybe they're just not very smart. But
well,
I find that so difficult to believe about Bill Gates. He seems to be so intelligent.
I couldn't believe he would support one world government when our country is in such straits. You would think he would be there to preserve our country's constitution and our Bill of Rights and Ten Commandments.
Well, I really can't comment on that. All I can do is tell you that many people are well rewarded for their service to the rulers of this world.
There's they are introducing a bill to stop the funding of Planned Parenthood. This gives people a chance to call in support of taking away. You'd be amazed at how many millions they get every year.
Yeah, well, of course, they President Bush actually increased the funding for Planned Parenthood this year. And I just don't understand why a Christian president would be increasing the funding for Planned Parenthood. But he did. And he's been funding International Planned Parenthood, for many years.
Jay Sekulow is leading the fight and to stop the funding. So if people called all over the United States, they would be able to give input on that and make it a more powerful statement.
Well, all I can say is just check all the facts, make sure that they're accurate. Don't believe anything that anybody tells you.
Well, I'm a member. I'm a member of Jay Sekulow's, I get all the mailings and stuff, and of course I support him the best I can, but that's how I find out about a lot of these things. So this is such an important issue, and
You might ask Jay Sekulow's organization why they opposed Judge Roy Moore when he was running for the governor.
What happened to Judge Roy Moore?
Well, of course, there were Christians like Jay Sekulow who opposed him. And when he was running for the governor, and in fact, we're having him as a guest on our program here in another week or so.
Oh, good, because everything became silent in regard to him running as governor.
Right.
And I would like to know about that.
Well, we hope to have him on as a guest here very, very soon.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Stan.
God bless you. Thanks so much, Laverne. Bye-bye. Okay, well, our telephone again, number again is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. If you have something you'd like to talk about, I would love to talk to you about it. But we started out the evening talking about this new legislation that had been passed. First of all, immediately after 9-1-1, they passed the Patriot Act. And then they passed the Office of Homeland Security Act. And then, of course, they passed the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act, and the whole idea of that was to be passed at the individual state level, but it was to follow the pattern that was laid out at the federal level, and, of course, it was really a case of an epidemic of any sort, or a healthcare emergency, where they could come in and seize your home and your car and any gasoline or food or medicines that you had, and round people up and forcibly vaccinate them and put them in detention camps, of course, always to preserve their health because they were from the government and there to help. And it's well worthwhile getting a copy of the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act. And if you go back through my newsletters up at RadioLiberty.com, you will find we did a whole newsletter on this one draconian act. And you have to understand, ask yourself why the Bush administration was so intent upon getting this legislation passed. There are many provisions in the Patriot Act and the Office of Homeland Security Act. They were Bill Clinton's legislation that he tried to get passed after the Oklahoma City bombing, and Congress absolutely refused to give the government the right to increase surveillance and offer the phone taps and the violations of the Fourth Amendment, to being able to so-called sneak and peek inspections of a home without a warrant. At least you had 72 hours or something to get it, but to go into somebody's house when they were not there and to steal things from the house, but of course that would be used as evidence against them at some time in the future, but a total abrogation of the concepts of the Fourth Amendment. And then, of course, things have been pretty fairly quiet for some time until just last month when they passed the Military Commissions Act, which effectively suspends the right of habeas corpus. Now, it's supposedly just for military combatants, but then anybody can be cited as being a military combatant. It's supposedly just for non-citizens. You know, you can have a green card, you can be an immigrant, but they can still, hold you without the right to habeas corpus. But then, after all, if they're holding you, and you say you're a citizen, they can say you're not a citizen, and you cannot get into court, and the courts have no right, of course, at all to challenge any of the provisions of the things that are going on. In other words, you can say, I'm a citizen, and I want the right to appear before the court, and they can say, well, the courts can't intervene, and if you can't get the court to intervene, how can you prove you're a citizen of the United States? This is one of the most frightening acts I've ever seen, and I think every citizen should check out the provisions of the Military Commission Act. And then on top of that came the John Warner Defense Authorization Act, which actually allows the president, in the case of a epidemic, in the case of disorder, in the case of sometimes of a natural disaster or perhaps an attack, to basically establish martial law. In fact, Senator Patrick Leahy, who is the Democrat from Vermont, has said that this legislation not only allows but encourages the President of the United States to establish martial law. It's very difficult for most people to believe that this could really be going on in America. And there must really be a threat here because, after all, why would the President be passing legislation like this, if there wasn't a threat to America from the wicked Osama bin Laden, who's living in a cave in Pakistan? But the question is Osama bin Laden really still living? I'd suggest if you have any questions on that, why not go up to the internet and Google in the words Osama bin Laden dead, Osama bin Laden dead or died. And you'll find literally thousands of references to the fact that people throughout the world know that Osama bin Laden is dead. But don't you worry, you'll always hear him, new tape that just came forward, the CIA has it, they verified it's Osama bin Laden. Yep, you can really know it's Osama bin Laden because the government would never deceive you, would they? And of course, Osama bin Laden is always there being used as the threat, and that's why we have to forego our freedom, because if we don't forego our freedom, Osama bin Laden's going to take our freedom away from us. He's going to come over here and attack us. Well, people really don't realize, of course, there's always been a very close relationship between the bin Laden family and the Bush family. And if you go back into a lot of the things that have been written, for instance, the bin Laden family, a number of them were here in the United States at the time of the 9/11 attack, and they and the members of the Saudi family were allowed to fly out before it was, legal for anybody to be flying. You remember right after 9/11, there was a freeze that was put on flying, and at least as far as getting all the family people together, they were allowed to fly when nobody else was, and then once the ban was lifted on flying. They were allowed to fly out of the country. But, certainly there's a great deal to suggest that members of the Bin Laden family had been funding Osama all along. And why was nothing ever done to them? Well, it is because of the threat of Islamic terrorism. And, of course, for those of you who have never heard the story of Ali Muhammad, we're going to be doing some programs here in about 2 weeks. But Peter Lance has written a wonderful book on Ali Muhammad. It's called Triple Cross. And, of course, it's the story of a man who worked for the CIA and who worked for Osama bin Laden. And every time he got arrested here in the United States as a terrorist, he would always have people call the FBI and he would be turned loose. Here is the man who actually planned the bombing of the American embassies in Tanzania and in Kenya. He actually was directly responsible for the deaths of hundreds of people, and over 5,000 people were injured. And where is Ali Muhammad today? He's living comfortably in New York City under a government stipend. He has never been convicted. He's never been sent to prison for the crimes he committed against humanity. How could that possibly be? Well, you'll certainly want to read the book. You'll want to talk. Here are my interviews with Peter Lance, who wrote the book. And even more than that, there was a National Geographic program that came out maybe about 2 or 3 weeks ago. It was called The Disappearing Man. It was put out by National Geographic. And, of course, in the end of this story, they give you the impression that this man, who has never been convicted, is in a jail somewhere in the world. According to Peter Lance, he's really there, living in the lap of luxury in New York at your expense. Why could that be? Is it possible that a lot of things we believe really are true? Well, we've got, of course, Mike calling from Santa Cruz. Again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Mike, did you have a question or comment?
Comment. Regarding your caller, Mary,
yes.
Whose pastor did not like your book, I have to say I get a little bit angry when I hear about pastors like that are so closed-minded. And I just wondered if I could maybe help Mary out with a couple suggestions.
All right, fine.
One is she could have her pastor, or she could do this, get her Strong's Concordance and look up the word conspiracy, and she'll see that it's 31 or 32 times the word appears in Scripture, in the King James. And so what he could do, the pastor could do, is look at that himself, and he might have to decide that he should tell his people in his church not to read the Bible because it's a book all about conspiracy. And so I think that list that she got from Cutting Edge would be really, really good. I commend her for doing that. And I'd like to just say, Mary, please don't give up. Just keep going. From the way you were talking, it sounds like the guy's a blockhead, a very good-hearted blockhead, but a blockhead nonetheless.
Well, I think that a lot of people, Mike, have been conditioned. Anybody who mentions the word conspiracy obviously is a nut, a crackpot. He believes in black helicopters. He believes, of course, in little green men, with pointed heads. And he believes the devil's running around in red tights, with a pitchfork and horns. And he's really far out. But you're absolutely right. The recurrent theme throughout my ministry, and certainly in my book, is that we're involved in a conspiracy against God. This is what this is all about. Obviously, I suspect the minister did not read the book all the way through. I would simply hope that Mary would ask him, please read the book through from beginning to end. And then after you've read the book thoroughly, let me know what you think.
Yeah, that's the other thing. If he didn't read it, then he's betraying himself, and that he would criticize something he knows very little about.
Well, I thought there are a lot of people out there. They're good people, but there is this terrible spiritual blindness that is keeping people from being able to see things clearly.
Well, we've become a nation with half its brain tied behind its back. And a lot of it has to do, really, I think the real clarity for a nation comes from the pulpit. It has to do with ministers who really walk with God and really read their Bible and really shepherd their people by bringing them into the green grass of the Scriptures and their relationship with their Lord Christ, Jesus Christ. And when you have a pastor who is, as Mary described, when you have one like that that just talks over you and won't really converse with you, there's a problem there. And I seriously question, that's a pretty narrow, I'm taking a narrow approach, but when you have a pastor like that, he's not really fulfilling his role relationally with his people when he won't have a real conversation with them. Because, you know, if he truly believes she's wrong, then they could really have a conversation and he could do what he really feels he can to help set her right. Even if he's wrong, you know, they could explore it together. But, that's a problem, but Mary, just keep on going. Don't quit.
That's all
don't
you can up. Do, and just pray for your minister. And just ask him if he would read the book too. What does he think about the concluding remarks at the end of the book?
Yeah.
Ask him, and if he says he doesn't know what the concluding remarks at the end of the book, I think that would answer it. So, thanks very much, Mike.
Okay.
God bless. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course this is Open Lines Wednesday, and we always look forward to having an opportunity to hearing what you out there in the listening audience are concerned about. And if you have any questions or comments, why, of course, save them up for Wednesday. And we were just talking this evening about this new legislation, the John Warner National Defense Authorization Act, and, of course, the Military Commission Act. And you're not hearing much about that here in the United States. And you have to understand, in my estimation, the reason that this legislation was passed, because they know there's going to be increasing unrest in this country. It's going to be brought on by the economic situation, by the especially as more and more people are going to lose their jobs. And, of course, they brought the Mexican population in so they can play one group against the other. That's how you divide a country and create civil unrest here. And I really fear that this is what's going to happen. It is not simply by accident that they have given Halliburton $385 million to be used for building detention camps in the United States. It is not simply by accident that they actually have actual publications of the use of civilians internees in military camps. And we actually provide that for anybody. If they get some of our material on concentration camps, we have an excellent 4-tape set on concentration camps. We have an excellent some excellent videos. In fact, we have a concentration camp special. We've got Dan calling from New York. Dan, just about time, but do you have a question or comment?
Yes, Dr. Stan, I have a question. You mentioned that Mr. Padilla was held and is being held in very horrible conditions by the government. But I want to ask the difference or the reason why this has happened. Because do you remember the American Taliban that was caught in Afghanistan?
Right. That was John Walker, right.
Yes. He was rather quickly processed and given out a sentence. And I think he was given about 20 or 25 years, if I'm not mistaken. But in the case of Mr. Padilla, what it seems to be the case that he's being held, is it because, like you mentioned, that the one in Afghanistan and cooperated with the government, and Mr. Padilla
He didn't cooperate at all. He was terribly tortured. He was badly injured, and he was terrible things were done to him. If you have read the story of John Lynn Walker, and they were frightened to death that the information had come out. So they simply said, well, send him to prison for life, or he can take 20 years, and his lawyer betrayed him. They should have brought the information out, because the government never could have allowed that case to go to trial. We'll be back. Hold on for just a moment. We'll be right with you.
Yes, Dr. Stan.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. As far as the case about Padilla was, he was picked up coming back to the United States. He had been, of course, to Pakistan, and maybe he'd even been to an Islamic training camp. We really don't know. But he was accused by the government. And they told everybody that they were arresting him because he was planning on building a dirty bomb. He had been sent to America to build a dirty bomb to kill Americans. And on that basis, they arrested him. They, of course, mistreated him. They held him now as an American citizen. They denied him the right to habeas corpus and to a trial. Now, that's a total violation of the law. They violated the laws for 3 years. Finally, the Supreme Court insisted that he had the right to have a trial. They could not try him before a military commission. And of course, then when it came, when there was actually a preliminary hearing, it turned out he had been asked to become an infiltrator, work for the government. He refused. He said, "I can't spy on fellow Muslims," and that's why they arrested him and tortured him. I believe this is unconscionable. He is still being held. He has never yet had his trial. The government really doesn't really want to try him because they do not want this to come out in open court. That they have people who torture people here in the United States. Even more, of course, if you haven't ever read the case of Jesse Tretado or the case of Jesse Tretado's brother, who was tortured and killed in an Oklahoma City prison, and of course a judge eventually awarded the family over $1 million, which the government refuses to pay. Look up the case of Tretado, T-R-E-N-T-E-D-E-A-U, on the internet and read it through. Understand they do kill people. American citizens in American prisons, and nobody is ever held responsible. That's what's so frightening.
Right. Dr. Stan, before you let me go, how can people, the provisions of the Military Act and the Homeland Security Act, can that be read on your website, you said, or how can people get hold?
Certainly go up on the internet site and, you can just look up, Google in a Military Commissions Act. If you need to, you can call me off the air and I can give you some excellent sites where we have information, but there's a great deal of information on the John Warner National Defense Appropriations Act and the Military Commissions Act. And we've done a number of cases with John Clark, and I think we'll be having him on again to discuss that.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Good night. God bless.
God bless. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan. This is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. We're really dependent upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out 5 hours every single week, every single week on about 60 stations. But it's an expensive proposition if you believe we have a different slant, if you believe we truly are involved in a spiritual battle, being fought on a political and ideological battlefield. Why, of course, we hope many of you will give serious consideration, as Mary from Covina does, to help us on a regular basis, and we appreciate Mary's help and the help of the other people who really, month in and month out, really give sacrificially to help us do what we're doing. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, our number 1-800-544-8927. Now, we did have several interviews with Dr. Michael Kaufman. We're carrying his video, and it's got a lot of great information on it. It's got a great clip there with Lou Dobbs and another one with a doctor who's actually injecting the very chip, which may or may not be the mark of the beast. I don't know whether it is or not, but certainly these radioactive chips, these active radioactive chips that they're in the process of actually injecting into people today. So if you'd like to get that, it's called the Current Events, I think it is. It's called World Events and Prophecy. World Events and Prophecy, we think it's rather good. It's not as professionally made as some, but the material in it makes up for any of the technical imperfections. That's World Events and Prophecy, the great new 4-tape sets that we have now on globalism. The 4 tapes which we have go into the background of the Holocaust, the real story of the Holocaust that you're not going to hear elsewhere. And of course, if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. Remember our telephone number? It's 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests. And, well, tonight our guest is William Federer, certainly one of my favorite guests. I always love to have Bill with us. He has a tremendous amount of information. He does tremendous research on many subjects. In fact, recently he was called back to Washington, D.C. to give a briefing on the history of Islam and its relationship with the West. So tonight we're going to be talking about the history of Islam, and then, of course, we're going to end up talking about Thanksgiving. And, of course, what does the history of Islam have to do with Thanksgiving? We're going to have to wait and go ahead, Bill. Thanks so much for being with us.
Stan, great to be with you.
Okay. I'm going to let you take over, because with William Federer, I don't have to do much work. Go ahead.
Well, it's exciting to be on, and, of course, your introduction talks about the battle for Western civilization. And, really, that's where we're at right now. And but in order to get a good idea of the current situation, it's important to see ourselves in light of history. And of course, we have 5,000 years of recorded human history, and we're on the cutting edge, but we can learn from the past. And a couple of things I'd like to draw our attention to is, one, the fall of Rome. Now, Rome was the most powerful empire in the world. It had existed for close to 1,000 years when it started, before Christ, and went on to have all of Europe and up to Britain and the Holy Land and, the Middle East and all of Africa. And anyway, it fell in 476 A.D. The Roman Empire was being overrun with illegal immigrants, the Ostrogoths and the Visigoths, which were the East Germans and the West Germans, the Anglos, the Saxons, the Jutes, the Lombards, the Franks. And as they came across the Rhine River into the Roman Empire, at first they came slowly, and they would assimilate and learn the Latin language and the Roman Republican form of government, where they, had senators that they would send to Rome and so forth. Matter of fact, many of the people that came to Rome and were taken captive in Rome were the Eastern Slavic people. And so many Slavs ended up serving as servants in Rome that the word Slav took the connotation of servant. And today we pronounce it slave. That's where that word came from. Anyway, the illegal immigrants came across so fast that they eventually gave up the attempts to learn the Latin language, and they kept their own language, their German, their French, their Anglo, their so forth. And they mixed in a little Latin, sort of a Tex-Mex mix. And that's why we call them Romantic languages. The English and German and Italian and the Spanish all have little bits of Latin mixed in with them. But anyway, these immigrants came across so fast that they kept their own tribal form of government. And meanwhile, Rome had its military stretched around the world, putting out global fires from North Africa to the Middle East up to Britain. Rome was having terrorist attacks. Attila the Hun was coming in and wiping out whole cities of 75,000 people. Meanwhile, Rome had outsourced all of its grain production to North Africa. That was its grain basket. And when one of the tribes overran the Roman Empire, called the Vandals, believe it or not, that was the name of one of the tribes, they went in through Spain into North Africa and captured the grain fields. And so Rome was not able to mount a counterattack because it didn't have the resources. And then the city of Rome was all on welfare. They would give out free bread. And so they had to raise taxes to pay for this welfare program and to pay for all these expensive military expenditures. And then the people morally were debauched. They had their gladiator coliseum spectacles where they would...
Hold that thought right there. We'll be right back in just a moment with William Federer. Well, William, pick the story up there.
Well, Rome had gotten to the place where the preoccupation with blood and gore in the Colosseums and that couldn't be satiated. And then they had exposure of unwanted infants, where if a mother bore a child, she would lay it at the father's feet, and if the father inspected it and liked it, they would keep it. If not, the mother would have to get rid of it and would put it out in the woods or in some pagan temple, you know, and a lot of the early Christians would hear those babies crying and come and rescue them, and many became great preachers. And also, Rome had their gymnasiums, and of course you think, what's wrong with a gymnasium? Well, gym is the Greek word for naked. And so a gymnasium was where a bunch of naked men ran around, and then they had their homosexual bathhouses, and I went to school in Rome for 6 months in college, and we would tour the ruins, and you would see where the slaves would be under the floor to stoke the jacuzzis in the bathhouses to keep them bubbling, and Pompeii was their Las Vegas. It was where all the prostitution was, and that's at the foot of the Mount Vesuvius, that volcano that erupted and the ashes covered the city and killed everybody, but they unearthed it and we toured it, and of course you can still see the murals on the walls to see the specialties of the different prostitutes. I mean, the place was a very immoral place. And anyway, that gave birth to the saying that Rome fell from the inside. The 5th century historian Salvian said, the Goths lie but are chaste. The Saxons are savage in cruelty but admirable in chastity. What hope can there be for the Romans when the barbarians are more pure than they? O Roman people, be ashamed of your lives. Let no one think otherwise. The vices of our bad lives have alone destroyed us. And so when the Western Roman Empire fell, it created this power vacuum. I mean, there wasn't police and armies to keep order, so it was sort of like gang warfare. And anyway, in the Eastern Roman Empire is where the Byzantine Empire was. Its capital was Constantinople, but it was at war with Iran. That's right, Iran. Of course, back then they called it Persia. And the Zoroastrians of Persia came into the Byzantine Empire, and when they conquered the Holy Land, they actually destroyed every church in the Holy Land except the one in Bethlehem, because there was a mural of the three wise men, the Magi, you know, the wise men from the east who came from Persia. And, so the Eastern Roman Empire was now weakened through a war, and into this power vacuum Islam came and spread rapidly because there was no Roman Empire or Byzantine Empire to withstand it.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, our guest is William Federer, and he's simply giving us the history of what happened. Of course, Rome fell because it had become totally corrupt, and certainly, you know, they encouraged or they allowed massive illegal immigration, and eventually, of course, the people who came into the country did not assimilate, and so you had a divided country, and then there was moral depravity, whether homosexuality or adultery, and of course, it's into this totally immoral situation where the people were entertained with blood and circuses, where the family was destroyed effectively. Then, of course, Rome, the western half of Rome, fell in 476 A.D. And then, of course, the eastern half of the empire. Remember, the western half of the empire fell in 476, but the eastern part of the empire lasted another 800 to 1,000 years. And so Bill is talking about the Byzantine Empire, which is the eastern half of the empire, which had been established by Diocletian about 300. So pick up the story there, Bill.
Well, come about 622 A.D. is when Muhammad started his Islamic faith. And I'm sure your listeners are probably aware, but Muhammad couldn't read. And so all he knew about the Christian faith is what he heard through second and third hand stories. His father died, so he was raised by his uncle, who was a camel driver, and so he would go on trips. And the area of Arabia where Muhammad lived were where a lot of heresies were. There was the Nestorian heresy that said Jesus was all God. There was the Arian heresy that said Jesus was less than God. There was the Ebionites that said you had to be a Jew and poor before you could be a Christian. And matter of fact, Muhammad was married to his first wife by her uncle, who was an Ebionite Christian priest. And so these different stories were forming his theology, and just to give you an example, in the fourth century after Christ, there was the Gospel of Thomas written, and it's a little fanciful, fictitious stories, and all scholars acknowledge they know exactly when it was written, 4 centuries after Christ. Now, that would be like you and I writing a first-hand account of the pilgrims to show you how far removed 4 centuries are. But anyway, in this Gospel of Thomas, it has these stories. When Jesus was a little boy, he made clay birds and breathed on them, and they flew away. And he killed one of his playmates, and his dad made him raise him up again. Well, guess which story made it into the Quran? When Jesus was a little boy, he made clay birds and breathed on them, and they flew away. And when he killed one of his playmates, and his dad made him raise him up again. So these were sort of these, oral stories that were sort of floating around, and of course Muhammad couldn't read, and he thought the Trinity was the Father, Mary, and Jesus, up until about a month before he died. And then what he knew about the Jewish faith was second and third hand removed. So he couldn't read the Old Testament, and so there was the Talmud, which is a written commentary, and then the Midrash and the Mishnah, which were oral commentaries. And so he heard second and third hand removed there. And then the area of Arabia where he lived was where a lot of pagan religions were. Pagan gods were worshipped, and the most popular was the moon god Allah, and they worshipped a meteor rock. And so he sort of mixed all these together, thinking that it would appeal to all these three different groups. And when he went into Quraysh, which was a Jewish community there in Arabia, he thought they would be thrilled with his new monotheistic religion. Matter of fact, the Quran can be divided into two sets of verses, the Meccan verses and the Medina verses. The Meccan verses he wrote first, and you can remember that easily because M-E-C comes before M-E-D. So the Meccan verses tells the Muslims to bow to Jerusalem 5 times a day and to treat the people of the book with respect, the Jews and the Christians with respect. Well, when he was rejected by the Jews and the Christians, then he wrote his Medina verses that said to bow to Mecca 5 times a day and to be ruthless to the Jews and the Christians and not make friends with the infidel Christians and Jews. Anyway, so he had gone into Quraysh, and instead of accepting his religion, the Jews rejected him, and they actually had some battles. And so he was weak, and so he made a treaty and not to attack him for 10 years. Well, 22 months later, he broke the treaty and rode into Quraysh and cut off the heads of 700 Jewish men and sold the women and children as slaves. And so it set the treaty, it set the concept in Islam that when you're strong, you attack. When you're weak, you make treaties until you can get strong enough to attack. And, even when Yasser Arafat was questioned about a treaty he made with Menachem Begin back in 1994, he was at a mosque in South Africa, and they said, "How could you make a treaty with the infidel Jews?" And he said, "Oh, this is like the treaty that the Prophet made at Quraysh." So they all knew that, okay, this is the treaty you make until you can get strong enough to attack them. Anyway, Muhammad waged 66 battles in his lifetime. He had 14 wives. When his first wife was still alive, he was faithful to her, but then when she died, he sort of went after lots of wives. One was as young as 9 years old, and he was against divorce until he decided that he wanted one of his chief's, wives, and so he made him divorce her, and then he married her. Idea he had was that the whole world is divided between the house of Islam and the house of war, or the house of jihad. So in other words, the word Islam means submission. And a Muslim is somebody who has submitted, and submitted to the will of Allah. And then the other half of the world is the house of war, which is in the process of becoming the house of Islam. So they see the world as Muslim and going to be Muslim. The difference between a moderate Muslim and a violent Muslim is that a moderate Muslim thinks that Islam will eventually conquer the world, just not during their lifetime, so why get all bent out of shape? Just go to get along with everybody. The violent Muslim thinks that Islam will conquer the world now, and they're trying to make it happen. And of course, I sort of divide it into three groups. You have the violent Muslims, you have the ones who are afraid of the violent ones, and then you have the dead ones who weren't afraid of the violent ones. They always talk about this large group of moderate Muslims, but the moderates are afraid to speak out against the violent ones, because the violent ones, every now and then one does speak out, and the violent ones put out a fatwa against them and kill them. So the whole religion is held captive by the violent ones. And anyway, so Muhammad went right into a town and say, submit or die. If you didn't submit, you died. If you did submit, he'd say, get your sword and your horse, follow me to the next town. So they'd ride into the next town and say, submit or die. And if you didn't submit, you died. If you did submit, he'd say, get your sword and your horse, follow me to the next town. So there were 250 Catholic dioceses along North Africa in the 7th and 8th century. And, of course, this is before the Reformation, so just about all Christians were Catholic. And the Muslims wiped them all out. All the Holy Land was Byzantine, Christian, and Jewish. And in 636 A.D., after a four-month bloody siege, the Bishop of Jerusalem stood on the walls and surrendered the city. And then all of Spain was captured by the Muslims, and they held it for 700 years. And then all of Asia Minor, which is today Turkey, was captured by the Muslims. For those familiar with the Bible, the last book in the Bible has the Apostle John writing a letter to seven churches, to the church at Philadelphia, the church at Laodicea, the church at Thyatira and Sardis, and you know it says, if you don't repent, I'll remove your candlestick and all that. Anyway, all seven of those churches were wiped out by the Muslims, the invading Muslim Ottoman Turks. And they had a unique strategy of military conquest. It was called Janissaries, where the Muslims would conquer a Christian city and then take the young boys from 7 to 14 years old and force them into the Muslim army and force them to convert and then put them on the front lines of the army when they would attack the next Christian city. So they would use the enemy's children to attack the enemy. I mean, it's a sort of unique strategy. And, I mean, they had a whole system. It was called the Deshurva. Deshurva, it was called a blood tax or children tax, where, you know, they would conquer the area and they'd say, okay, we want tribute. We want your, you know, some of your produce from your land. We want your animals. We want your money. And we want your children. And, you know, the Janissaries could only grow a mustache, where the Muslims could have a full beard. And they sort of became the Sultan's private guard. And they looked to the Sultan as their father. And if any boys were more or less effeminate, they would end up becoming the sexual, pedophilia type ones for the Sultan. These Janissaries were known for being very strong warriors and very feared. And with the help of the Janissaries, the Muslims conquered Constantinople in 1452. This is a very important date because prior to 1452, there was trade that went from Western Europe through Constantinople, through Turkey, across the Gobi Desert, on the China Silk Road to India and China. And ever since Marco Polo on, Marco Polo was that Italian in 1271 that found his way over to China and worked for Kublai Khan for 25 years. But from Marco Polo on, there was trade routes from Western Europe through Constantinople, through the Gobi Desert and so forth to China. Well, once Constantinople fell in 1452 to the Muslims, it cut off the land trade route. And so Western Europeans were trying to come up with an alternative route to trade with India and China, and that's when Columbus said, I know how to get there, sail west, in 1492. And Columbus thought the islands he discovered were around India, so he named the inhabitants the Indians. He thought that Haiti was Japan. He thought that Cuba was the tip of China. It wasn't until his fourth voyage that he realized that he had not found the place. But it highlights the fact that if Islam was a peaceful religion in the 1500s, Columbus, you know, would have never set sail there in the 15th century. So the very fact that America's discovered is a byproduct of jihad. This is a problem that didn't start with Bush and didn't start with Clinton. It went all the way back over 1,500 years ago, and the Muslims almost conquered Europe, but they were held back at Vienna. Matter of fact, the founder of Georgia, the colony of Georgia, was James Oglethorpe, and he fought the Muslims there at the gates of Vienna, Austria, back in the late 1600s and early 1700s. And
all right, fine. We'll be back here in just a moment with Bill Federer and Chris. We'll keep exploring this whole incredible story of the conflict between Christianity and the Muslim faith. All right, go right ahead, Bill.
So we sort of given an overview picture of the world at the time. You know, it's interesting. James Oglethorpe fought, when he was 17 years old, fought for the King of Austria against the invading Muslims there at the gate of Vienna. And had it not been for John Sobieski, who was the Polish king, coming to the rescue of Austria, Austria would have fallen. And anyway, so after that time, it sort of settled down to a brief period of, I guess, more or less peace. It was where the Muslims had their house of Islam, and the rest of the world was the house, you know, of war. They did do piracy on the open seas, and the Barbary pirates of North Africa, and they were the ones involved with the slave trade. Most people don't realize that the slaves that were purchased by the Europeans and brought to America were purchased from the Muslims, because the Muslims, in their Quran, slavery is okay, and so they would capture these black slaves and buy them from the tribes and then be there at the ports where they would sell them to the Europeans. But there were several instances where the Muslims actually would capture American ships and enslave our sailors. But in 1740, they had a reformation, so to speak. They had a cleric in Arabia called Wahhabi, and he said, look, we've backslidden from the words of Allah, and we've become lukewarm in our quest to conquer the world. And so he said that they needed to return to the words of Allah. And of course, you know, Surah 5:17 says, an infidel is one who believes that God is Christ, the Son of Mary. Surah 5:71 says, an infidel is one who believes that God is one of three in eternity. And then it goes on to say, believers, be ruthless to the infidels. It says those, the followers of Allah, are ruthless to infidels. It says, make war on the infidels that dwell around you, Surah 9:101. It says, when you meet an infidel on the battlefield, strike off their heads. Of course, you contrast this to Jesus that said, forgive your enemies, love those that persecute you. When you, struck on one cheek, turn the other. So quite a different teaching by the leaders of these two faiths. Anyway, so the Saud family hooked up with the Wahhabi sect, and they conquered all of Arabia. And that's why it's called Saudi Arabia, because the whole place belongs to the Saud family. And but they were mainly tent dwellers. It took Sir Lawrence of Arabia to try to organize them to throw off the Ottoman Turks, because they couldn't organize themselves, because they were just, you know, tribes living in tents. But finally, in 1924, oil was discovered in Arabia. And so that's when they began to get millions and millions of our dollars, and they funneled it into spreading their Islamic faith. And for example, 9 out of the 10 mosques in America are Wahhabi sect mosques, and they're spreading their more violent version of Islam. And they buy chairs at major universities. To buy a chair means that they donate $1 billion to Harvard or Yale or Georgetown, and they build a mosque and the Islamic Studies Center, and then they kick. This year, Georgetown accepted a large gift from Saudi Arabia. And,
hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment. Here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Bill Federer. He's really giving us the background of the history of the Islamic faith, and of course, what happened during about the 1740s or so. A man named Wahhab, living in Saudi Arabia, said, look, we've got to get back to a more fundamental faith. We've turned our back on the original teachings of the Prophet, and so he teamed up with the family of Ibn Saud and created what today is Saudi Arabia. And then, of course, as time went by, we find them striking oil in Saudi Arabia in the 1920s. And then, of course, we find the growing alliance between the West and Saudi Arabia. They, of course, getting a great deal of money from their oil, and at least part of that money is going into proselytizing their faith throughout the world. The radical form of Islamic faith, and right here in the United States, 90% of the mosques here are teaching this radical form of Islam. So pick up the story, Bill.
And just this past May 21st, the Washington Post ran an article having excerpts from Saudi textbooks, quote-unquote, after the intolerance had been removed. And, of course, a first-grade textbook says every religion other than Islam is false. A third-grade textbook says that there will be world peace when there is world Islam. That sort of highlights the fact that Islam is a religion of peace. It's just that their definition of peace is when the whole world has submitted to Allah. And so when the whole world becomes Islamic, to them, that's world peace. Whereas we think of world peace as peaceful coexistence. They don't. They think it is when the whole world's conquered by Islam. Anyway, in a fifth grade textbook, it says, when you meet a Christian or a Jew on a narrow road, do not yield to them out of respect. I had to read through that a couple times. It says, do not yield to them out of respect. In other words, you have to force them to get out of your way. It says, you forgive your enemy only after you have conquered them. Another verse says, in an eighth grade textbook, it says, Jews are from apes, Christians are from swine. Another verse says that a Muslim, even if they are distant, is your close friend, and someone who does not believe in Allah is your enemy, even if they are your closest family member. And then I couldn't believe it's had a chapter on blood money in an 11th grade textbook, a jurisprudence. It says blood money is the retribution paid to a family upon the death of a relative. And it had the blood money for a Muslim male was a certain amount, while a blood money for a Muslim female was half of that. And a blood money for a Christian male was equal to a female Muslim, and a Christian woman was half of that, and a Jewish man was equal to a Christian woman, and a Jewish woman was half of that, and then the Buddhist and Hindu were like one-tenth of that. So they have different values for human life.
Well, now, of course, Bill, who prepared this book that you were referring to? In other words, what is the source of the information?
This is the Washington Post that got a hold of the Saudi textbooks that are used in these mosques that are all across America.
Do you have any idea what the date was out of the article? I'd love to track
that. It was May 21st, 2006.
May 21st, 2006. Thank you.
And they had pressured Saudi Arabia because their previous textbooks were even worse. And so Saudi Arabia said, okay, we'll revise our textbooks and take out the intolerance. And so this was the title of the Washington Post article. It says, this is a Saudi textbook after the intolerance had been removed. You know, of course, tongue-in-cheek, it still was intolerant. But it highlights the fact that this is not, something that is done in a corner. I mean, this is the Washington Post writing about this. And it's interesting, I have a book that was written by Teddy Roosevelt. And he was the youngest president, and he took over when William McKinley died, was assassinated. But in 1916, Teddy Roosevelt wrote a book called Fear God and Take Your Own Part, sort of an in-your-face type of title. But anyway, on page 196 of this book, Teddy Roosevelt writes this: Christianity is not the creed of Asia and Africa at this moment, solely because the 7th century Christians of Asia and Africa had trained themselves not to fight, whereas the Muslims had trained themselves to fight. Christianity was saved in Europe solely because the people of Europe fought. If the people of Europe in the 7th and 8th century, up to and including the 17th century, had not possessed a military equality with and a gradual growing superiority over the Mohammedans who invaded Europe, Europe would at this moment be Mohammedan, and the Christian religion would be exterminated. Wherever the Mohammedans have had complete sway, wherever the Christians have been unable to resist by the sword, Christianity has ultimately disappeared. From the hammer of Charles Martel to the sword of John Sobieski, Christianity was saved in Europe, owed its safety in Europe to the fact that it could and would fight as well as the Mohammedan aggressor. And again, that was Teddy Roosevelt in 1916 writing that. And so we see that, again, this is a battle that's been going on for about 1,500 years.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. All right. Bill, why don't you go ahead and pick up the story there?
And one other chapter, I wrote a book called Treasury of Presidential Quotations. And it's quotes from all 43 presidents, what they said about faith and so forth. And there's a number of interesting quotes from the late 1800s. And, for example, here's a quote from Grover Cleveland in 1896. And he writes about the situation in Turkey. And he says this, it would afford me satisfaction if I could assure Congress that the disturbed condition in Asiatic Turkey during the last year had assumed a less hideous and bloody aspect. Instead, we have been afflicted by continued and not infrequent reports of wanton destruction of homes and bloody butchery of men, women, and children made martyrs to their profession of the Christian faith. While none of our citizens in Turkey have been killed or wounded thus far, they are often in the midst of dreadful scenes of danger. It says, the outbreaks of blind fury which lead to murder and pillage in Turkey occur suddenly and without notice. We've made claims to the Turkish government. A number of Armenian refugees have begun to appear at our ports. I do not believe that the present somber prospect in Turkey, and again I'm quoting from Grover Cleveland, the 24th president, says, I do not believe the present somber prospect in Turkey will long be permitted to offend the sight of Christendom. But boy, when was the last time we heard that word, Christendom? He says, it so mars the humane and enlightened civilization that belongs to the close of the 19th century that it seems hardly possible that the earnest demand of good people throughout the Christian world for its corrective treatment will remain unanswered. Over and over again, though, we have, you know, Grover Cleveland, Benjamin Harrison, William McKinley, we've got Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, all writing about the Muslims killing the Christians in Turkey. Matter of fact, when Woodrow Wilson started his League of Nations, where he wanted America to surrender its sovereignty to this international body, the first thing that he wanted to do was called his Mandate for Armenia. In other words, he wanted this new global, community to step in to stop the killing of the Christians that was going on in Armenia by the Muslims. And he gives a real strong Christian plea. He says, you know, that our Christian faith, you know, requires us to come to their aid. Now, I have no problem with coming to their aid, but the problem that America had was surrendering its sovereignty to this League of Nations group. So obviously that failed. But, it's an interesting part of world history that the jihad, these outbreaks of blind fury that occur suddenly and without notice, it didn't just happen with the Danish cartoon or with their response to the Pope.
This is Dr. Stan back here. I guess this is William Feder. He's simply talking about the tragic situation that existed during the Second World War, First World War, and immediately following that, where the Turks were slaughtering the Armenians. Of course, there's always been very, very strong feelings between the two races, but this was the terrible, terrible time. In fact, we have some audio tapes on that in the four-tape set we carry called The Other Holocaust. Goes into the Armenian Holocaust, and there were about 1 million to 1.5 million Armenians who were just slaughtered at that time immediately following the Second World War, First World War. So pick up the story there, Bill.
So it sort of gives us a little bit of an insight into where we're at today. And people say, well, there's just a small group. I was with Dr. James Dobson about 2 weeks ago. I had the privilege of speaking at Mount Rushmore with him and Dr. Alan Keyes and Dr. Rick Scarborough. And I was emceeing the event and as well as giving the closing remarks, but Dr. Dobson said, we're always being told that the violent Muslims are just a small minority. But he says, when you have 1.5 billion Muslims, a small percentage of 1 billion is still a large number. He says a small percent of a large number is a large number. But one of the things I think is important is that what are weapons other than power magnifiers? You have a little lady on the street and 10 thugs come up and want to rape her and beat her. Well, she's got no power to withstand them unless you give her a machine gun, and then she can quickly equalize the situation. And it's like, you know, there's a, if there's a small minority of violent Muslims that hate us, but now there are new weapons of destruction that are so powerful that, wait a second, they do become a very a terrible threat. And, of course, we've talked in shows past how the globalists are taking advantage of this threat and more or less using it, and to a certain extent they may have even created it. I mean, it was Jimmy Carter that pulled the rug out from underneath the pro-West Shah to create the Ayatollah Khomeini, who was the one to instigate all the anti-West, and, you know, Zbigniew Brzezinski was the one that told Jimmy Carter what to do. And so it's almost like the triangle, that they need an enemy or they need an excuse, but it's a legitimate enemy. I mean, it's one that really does genuinely hate us, but unfortunately, the answer that's being suggested is for us to surrender our sovereignty to solve it. And but one of the things, getting back to world history, again, when the Muslims invaded through Spain in the you know, early 700s, Charles Martel, one of the early French kings, he was the father or grandfather of Charlemagne, which is Charles the Great in French, but he withstood the Muslims in the valley of the Pyrenees Mountains, and story goes it was a three-day battle, and the third day they thought they were going to be slaughtered. The Muslims had invented the stirrup, which was a military advantage that they had. They could put the full force of a gallop behind their sword, and stories of slicing somebody in half and then the top of the body would fall off, you know. You see those movies where somebody would take a sword and cut a candle, you know, and then it would tip over. But the Europeans at that time just had they were just ride on a horse, but they hadn't invented the stirrup yet. But so Europe was the Holy Roman Empire. It was all Catholic, and I'm sort of switching into the part of history leading up to the Pilgrims now. In 1517, Martin Luther started the Reformation, and different kings would decide to be Lutheran, and different kings would decide to be Catholic, and the warfare was finally temporarily stopped with the Peace of Augsburg. And the Peace of Augsburg said that whatever the king believed, the kingdom had to believe. They used the Latin term curios et regio, curios et religio, which means whose is the reign, his is the religion. And so some countries were Lutheran and some were Catholic, but then other different Protestant groups began. The Anabaptists, the Calvinists, and the Dutch Reformed, and the Swedish Lutheran, and so finally they passed the Peace of Westphalia in 1648, and Europe had pretty much divided to where England was Anglican, Scotland was Presbyterian, Sweden was Swedish Lutheran, and Holland was Dutch Reformed, and Northern Germany was Lutheran. Italy, Spain, and France, and Austria, Poland were Roman Catholic. Greece was Greek Orthodox, Russia was Russian Orthodox, and Switzerland was Calvinist. And if you didn't believe the way the king did, you were persecuted and you fled. And so there was this mass migrations of people groups all across Europe. And thus it led to the immigration to America. And the first main group that came to America, I just recently wrote a new book called The Original 13, where I have researched every one of the original colonies for the original 13 states, and then the original state constitutions, and then every amended constitution up to the present, and highlighted every reference to God, faith, Christianity. Every one of the charters for the colonies was for extending the Christian faith and propagating the Christian faith to such people as yet live in darkness, to the reduction of the savages to the Christian and civilized religion, you know. The Swedish Lutherans founded Delaware, the Dutch Reformed founded New York, the Puritans founded Massachusetts, the Church of England, Anglicans founded Virginia and the Carolinas, the Congregationalists settled Connecticut, the Baptists settled Rhode Island, the Quakers settled Pennsylvania, Maryland was a colony for persecuted Catholics. They had were ahead of their time in 1649. They let any Protestant or any Christian hold office, and more Protestants got elected and voted them out. So they had to wait till after the Revolutionary War to have a Catholic Church in Maryland again. But anyway, the migration first started with the Virginia Anglicans, but their colony was basically a business endeavor. They had the London Company and then the New England Company and the Virginia Company, and they were had stockholders and long lists of stockholders when you read these charters. I mean, hundreds of them, and they were all investors, sort of like you'd invest in the Ford Motor Company, and they all expected a return, hopeful of a similar return that the Spanish were getting with gold. They didn't know what was out there. Some thought that they could find a passage to China. Others thought that at the very least they could fish or find some crop to send back. As it was, the Pilgrims found the beaver skin to send back, and that's what they used to pay off their debt for their boat ride. The first main group that settled in America were the Puritans, prior to the Puritans coming over were the Pilgrims. And it's an interesting story. The King of England was Henry VIII, and he had split from the Roman Church because his wife, Catherine of Aragon, the daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella, the ones who sent Columbus to America, she didn't have a male heir. She had a daughter named Mary, but not a son, so Henry decided to divorce her. And the Pope said, no, I'm not going to recognize the divorce. And Henry said, the heck with you, I'll be my own Pope. So Henry VIII started the Church of England, and he went on to have six wives, and their fates were divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived. So Henry VIII was not a really nice guy to be married to. Anyway, his advisor suggested that if he really wanted to break with Rome, he should stop using the Latin Bible and get an English Bible. And so for more or less political reasons, Henry VIII spread the English Bible around England. But something unexpected happened. People began to read it and compare what was in this Bible to this king divorcing and beheading his wives and being over the church. And so this group wanted to purify the Church of England. Thus, they were nicknamed the Puritans. They were persecuted and whipped. When they were caught, they were purged from academia. A few kings later was Charles I. Charles I hired an Anglican archbishop by the name of William Laud. And Laud sent spies into all the churches to make sure they were following the official Anglican liturgy. And if they weren't, they were imprisoned. Laud arrested Alexander Layton, who was a Oxford professor, and had him sentenced to have his nose cut in half, his ears cut off, branded on the face as a heretic, whipped twice, and put in prison until he died. Laud was not a really nice guy. Laud put a list of all the leaders in England with an O or a P by their name, O for Orthodox and P for Puritan, and all the Puritans lost their jobs and was purged from academia. William Penn, for example, was kicked out of Oxford for having a Bible study in his dorm room rather than going to the Anglican chapel service. Sort of gives you an idea of how strict that they were. But there was another group that said, the Church of England is beyond hope of trying to purify. We're just simply going to separate ourselves. And like the legal churches, house churches in China, these separatists would meet in secret and in barns and basements by candlelight to read the Bible and pray in the scriptures. And when they were caught, they were arrested and put in the stocks and so forth. William Bradford writes about the separatists and how one group sold their houses and lands and bought passage on a ship to take him to Holland, where there was a little bit of religious freedom. And the captain, before he set sail, robbed all these separatists and turned them over to the authorities, and they were put in prison. Another group of separatists sold, and they called themselves separatists because they felt like that the state government should be separated from controlling the church government. They didn't like the state government sending spies into the churches. They wanted to have the church free from being controlled by the state, so they wanted it to be separate. But another group of these separatists sold their houses and lands and made arrangements with a Dutch captain to pick them up on the side of England And while the men were ferrying out and storing the supplies onto the ship, the British came over the hill and captured the women and the children. And the men were on the Dutch ship. The Dutch captain pulled anchor and started sailing away. And the women are like, "Husband, get back here." Well, for 3 years, they passed those women and children from one court in England to another. Finally, one of the judges said, "You really didn't do anything wrong. You were just obeying your husbands, and therefore go back home." And they said, "We can't go home. We sold our homes." And so out of frustration, they got a ship and put the women on with their children and sent them over to Holland to be reunited with their husbands. So sort of a happy ending to that chapter there. But while they were in Holland, after 12 years, they had to work 2 and 3 jobs each, and it was a very tough life, and they scraped together. But they saw how their children were assimilating into the Dutch culture, learning the Dutch language and the looser morals and so forth, and they realized that no one else was really joining them from England, and so their little movement was going to be a one-generation movement, and then they would end up just being, you know, assimilated into the Dutch. So the and then Spain was making motions to attack Holland, which they eventually did, and of course the Dutch responded by flooding the dikes. They had broke the dikes and let the water rush in, and it drowned the Spanish army there. But this is before that happened. But these separatists decided that they were going to flee again, and this time they thought of going to British Guyana in South America because it was warm weather and so forth, but then they heard about the tropical diseases and the Spanish Main. That's the area of the Caribbean controlled by Spain. And the horrible stories of the French Protestants at Jacksonville, Florida. Back then it was called Fort Caroline on the St. John's River, but they had in 1565, had a little colony there, but the Spaniards came and wiped them out, you know, cut off the heads of 300 men there and took the women and children captive. And so the pilgrims didn't want to go anywhere near Spain, and so they decided to go to Jamestown. And they got a ship called the Speedwell, but it didn't speed too well, and it began leaking, so they had to go back and swap it out in 2 other false starts. Finally, they got on the Mayflower, and but during that time they were eating up the supplies that they were supposed to be saving for when they got to the New World, but they didn't have any other choice. And then they were sailing later in the season, and that's when the North Atlantic was more stormy. And so over a month journey, these separatist pilgrims were confined to the between deck, a little 4-foot-high space that tossed and turned and was putrid-smelling. And one young pilgrim was so tired of the smell that he went topside to get some fresh air just as a freezing wave swept over the deck, knocked him overboard. Luckily, his arm caught a rope, and they pulled him in. And he was blue, but he survived. His name was John Howland, and his descendants included Franklin Roosevelt, and one of the descendants was George Bush. Anyway, the storm was so bad it cracked the beam that was holding up the main mast, and one of the pilgrims was a printer, stuck his printer screw under there and piled up, you know, boxes, and they screwed the screw and it pushed the beam back in place. They finally got blown off course, and instead of landing at Jamestown, they were way up at Cape Cod. And the Captain Jones tried to get back out and go around, but the storms were so bad that he basically said, "This is where you're going to spend the winter, so get used to it." The pilgrims realized that there was no government at Jamestown for them to submit to. So they didn't want to just get off the boat and not have any form of government, so they decided to write their own form of government. And they wrote the Mayflower Compact, which starts off, "In ye name of God, amen, we the hereby undersigned, having undertaken for the glory of God and the advancement of the Christian faith, a voyage to plant the first colony on the northern parts of Virginia, in ye presence of God, we mutually covenant ourselves together into a civil body politic." And so this was a revolutionary idea that people could covenant themselves together under God and create their own form of government. I've read through, and I have them all in my book, the original 13. Every other charter is the King James I grants the permission. You know, Queen Elizabeth grants the permission for Sir Walter Raleigh, King Charles I grants the the land from Maryland, King Charles II grants William Penn the charter for Pennsylvania. King George I grants James Oglethorpe the land for Georgia's. It's always the king, but here this Mayflower Compact was the people granting themselves permission to form their own form of government. So it was not only the first government document written in the New World, it was a self-government document.
Bill, we're running out of time. I want you quickly to give your website so people can get in touch with you and maybe get some of your books, those we don't carry. Go ahead.
My website's AmericanMinute.com, AmericanMinute.com, and then I have a toll-free telephone number. It's 1-888-USA-WORD, 1-888-USA-WORD. But the AmericanMinute.com, they can sign up for my free daily email call, the American Minute.
All right, fine. Bill's material is excellent. We recommend it strongly, and well, we're going to be back in just a moment or two to wrap up this evening's program here at Radio Liberty. Well, Bill, you've got the Puritans ashore there. They've written the Mayflower Compact, and then what happened?
Well, that Mayflower Compact was the blueprint for Connecticut, and then Connecticut's Constitution was the blueprint for the U.S. Constitution. That's why it says, we the people of the United States, we're granting ourselves permission for the government. But it's interesting, the men got off the Mayflower, began to chop wood, build their buildings, and would sweat and catch a cold and a fever and a pneumonia and die. One died, two, three, four, a dozen, two dozen, three dozen. Half of the pilgrims, there was 102 of them, half of them died the first winter. And at one point there was only two of them healthy enough to stand. Only five couples retained their original spouses. I mean, the next spring so many had died that the widows began to marry the widowers to sort of patch together their families. They wouldn't have survived another year had not out of the woods walked an Indian by the name of Squanto. And a fascinating story, 3 years before the pilgrims landed, William Bradford writes about a French ship was shipwrecked at Cape Cod, and the sailors got ashore, but the Indians never left watching them and dogging them till they got the advantage and killed them all but three or four, whom they sent from one sachem to another, making sport with them, using them worse than slaves. Indians would do things like tie somebody up to a post and gnaw the meat off their fingers and take bites out of their arms while they're still alive right in front of their face. Could you imagine somebody eating your arm right in front of you? Anyway, but evidently a disease was spread to that tribe and wiped it out. So the pilgrims basically landed on the one spot on the eastern coast of America that was uninhabited. There was no Indian tribe there because it had died. The French and the Dutch and the English would fish along the coast of America and sometimes lure Indians on board and then capture them and teach them their language so that the Indians could show them the good fishing spots. And then to turn a quick buck, they'd sell them as slaves in Malaga, Spain, the big slave trading port, make about $2,000 equivalent for a slave. And the story is that one of these Indians was purchased by some monks, and they freed him, and he made his way to England, and after several years of working there, found a captain to drop him off at Newfoundland, where he worked for a few more years, and then he finally got dropped back off at Cape Cod, only to find out that his family had been wiped out by this plague. And so the Indian Squanto went to live with another tribe, and that next spring, after the pilgrims had had half of their group die, Squanto found out about him and went there, and William Bradford writes that he was a special instrument sent of God for their good beyond their expectation. He told them how to catch fish, how to plant corn, how to catch beaver.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here with Bill. Well, Bill, go right ahead here.
And it took them 40 years worth of beaver skins to pay off their debt to Thomas Weston. You know, whenever you see the pictures of the pilgrims coming over, you never ask yourself the question, who's paying for this boat ride? Well, Thomas Weston was the financier, and he charged them exorbitant interest rates and changed their terms many times. So it took 40 years worth of beaver skins, but Squanto taught them how to catch beaver. But most importantly, he put them on good terms with the other Indian tribes. And so that led to that whole first generation never having any Indian problems. And William Bradford writes about their first Thanksgiving. And, of course, the Indians brought turkey and wild deer, and the English people had their puddings and so forth. And at the end of the day, the Indians just rolled up in their bear skins and slept, and the next day they were still there, so the Thanksgiving went on for a second day. And then at the end of that day, they rolled up in their bear skins, and then the third day they were still there, so Thanksgiving went on a third day. And the chief wouldn't come, but the young warriors did, and they left their bows and arrows outside the camp, and it was just a wonderful experience. And the Indians were kind to the pilgrims, especially because of Squanto. William Bradford continues to write how several years later they were exploring the bay, and a freezing rain came up, and he says they couldn't get around the shoals, so they put in at Manamoyac Bay, and he said, here Squanto fell ill of Indian fever, bleeding much at the nose, which the Indians take for a symptom of death. He says Squanto bequeathed several of his belongings to his English friends, and he begged Governor Bradford to pray for him that he might go to the Englishman's God in heaven. I thought, boy, what a testimony. I mean, here the pilgrims are living their, you know, Christian faith in front of him. And his response was that his last request was to pray for him that he would go to the Englishman's God in heaven. And William Bradford's colony continued on. They had several more boatloads come. Matter of fact, after that first Thanksgiving, another boatload of pilgrims came, and they didn't have any supplies with them. They had eaten up their supplies, and so what little was saved, the pilgrims had to split with these new arrivals. And that second winter, they got to the place where they had to ration 5 kernels of corn a day. Can you imagine that? And the next spring, the instructions from the financiers for their little colony said that they had land that was held in common by the company, and that everybody had to take turns working the land. Well, nobody wanted to work on it because they were sick and so forth. And so William Bradford scrapped the communism and said, look, everybody gets their own plot of land. Whatever grows on it, you get to keep. And guess what? All the, you know, sick people were out there. The mom had her baby on the hip. They're out there working the fields. Until that fall, they had a tremendous harvest, and they had another Thanksgiving. And William Bradford gives this Thanksgiving proclamation. And so we have this tradition in America that every fall there's a Thanksgiving to God.
And friends, that's what it was all about, was the Thanksgiving to God. Bell, we're out of time. It's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan, and it was a fun world tour here. And AmericanMinute.com, if anybody wants to visit or sign up for the email or get any of my books.
And get that telephone number just one more time.
It's 1-888-USA-WORD, 1-888-USA-WORD.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Dr.
Good
Stan.
Night. God bless. All right, fine. Well, that was Bill Federer, certainly one of my favorite guests. I hope he's one of yours as well. And of course, this is a time I just need to remind our listeners, Radio Liberty is listener-supported. We hope to hear from you. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And, of course, if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, like to get some of our books, if you'd like, of course, to get one of our catalogs or even get a free copy of our newsletter, give us a call, 1-800-544-8927. And remember, nothing has changed. They were involved in a spiritual battle when America was founded. We're involved in a spiritual battle today. There's a conspiracy against God, and we have to stand up for our beliefs. So please pray for America, pray for revival, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Until tomorrow evening at the same time, may the Lord be with you.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
morning, good afternoon, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Wherever you're situated on this great, big, beautiful blue globe floating through the void of Yah's creation, it is Wednesday. It's the 15th of November. It's 2006, and it's time for people all over the country to realize, yeah, we got taken in. We got snookered. Yeah, we got lied to. There's no crime in being made a fool of. However, if we go back for a second time, that's when we